All right, we're going to begin then today formally. We looked at some background material about the Song of Solomon. We accept that it was written by Solomon, and there are other critics who want to say, no, it probably wasn't. We believe what it says. I should also let you know, the Song of Solomon is probably one of the most challenging books for people, scholars through the centuries, to interpret. In ancient times, these so-called Bible scholars, they didn't want to believe this is actually about what it seems to be about, sex and marriage and things like that, because sex was supposed to be a bad thing, according to the early Catholic Church fathers. And so they came up all sorts of ways to explain away a lot of what seems to be the natural reading of this. Our approach with Scripture is to take it for what it says. And if you can't quite take it strictly on a literal level, and you really can't, well, then you have to start looking at it as the metaphor, what's going on. And as a topic of a love poem, a poem about love and marriage, courtship, and that sort of thing, there's going to be a lot of metaphor. It's very hard to explain, to describe feelings and emotions, that anticipation of marriage and the hope for the future and all that. Some scholars think this is was entirely written as one solid poem. Others see it as a series of poems put together. My background, my training helps me understand this poem in a way that maybe I can show you. It'll help you understand it. A lot of times when we read a narrative, a story has a nice storyline, doesn't it? It kind of begins at the ending. It has highs and lows. Maybe it comes to a peak of most intensive part of the story, and then it tapers off and ends somewhere. Okay, this is kind of like the storyline. What this poem seems to do is what a lot of poems written in the 20th century and even still today tend to do. A lot of writers today, as it were, they look at the storyline, and it's as if they draw an imaginary line, and then they only give us the high parts of the story. And so what they're doing is they're taking out these connections that unite the different major episodes of the story. And what we often get in the story then is just the highlights of the story. Am I making sense? You following my... Okay. And so now this can be very disconcerting. If you want to read... And it can't be. When you read the Song of Solomon, it seems like it jumps around a lot. It's starting here, then all of a sudden the scene shifts, and it seems, are we out in the garden again or something? And then we shift, and now we're in the city, and we just kind of shift suddenly and unexpectedly. And it's as if the poet maybe just given its highlights of what is an otherwise connected storyline. What we have to do then, to a certain degree, we're kind of forced to make connections. We have to substitute in our own minds the connectors, what's going on in the story. Sometimes, if you ever made a collage in school, you know what a collage is? Okay, somebody define for me a collage. What do you do when you make a collage? Let's say somebody says, maybe in elementary school, they said, okay, make a collage of your favorite things. And what do you put on that collage? You go to the magazine, you cut out pictures, and what do you put out there? What did you put on your collage, John? A bunch of random pictures of things you like or things that interest you. Maybe puppy dogs. I don't know. This is many years ago. Maybe a Corvette. Okay, and you have all these different images, maybe a mountain scene, and they're not really connected logically by a narrative, but they're flashes of images, and from those flashes, we're able to put together an overall picture. I remember when MTV first started creating music videos back in the 80s, probably decades before some of you were born, right? It was really weird. It was strange because they had music, and then they just have these flashes of images, and we were expected to stitch it together. You're probably used to that, right? That is something you've grown up with, and I say that because I've looked at a number of music videos, and that's what they do. Even advertisements nowadays on TV, they often have flashes of images, and sometimes you still see a little narrative-type ad, but a lot of times it's just flashes, and then we have to stitch together all these images and make meaning out of it. To a certain degree, that's what helps me understand Song of Solomon. If I focus too hard on trying to make a literal connection between these episodes in the poem, I will get frustrated. But if I kind of relax and approach it more like we do with modern advertising or videos or or what have you, it seems to make a little more sense. So what I'm suggesting to you is that at our age and time right now, we may have an easier time understanding this poem than people would have understood it a century ago or before, because they were really stuck with wanting that narrative, that nice connecting narrative. So I thought I'd throw that out there. I think that might help us as we go along. There are parts of this poem that are just enigmatic. People do not know exactly what's going on. You can look up a number of commentaries, and what you find is people offering suggestions, but a lot of people saying, we don't really know, we don't quite understand. And again, we're dealing with a poetry from a culture that's not our culture. It's from roughly 3,000 years ago. And their values, although based in scripture, there's a lot of other cultural things and historical things going on that we've just lost. We don't really understand what it is that they're doing. So we have to be patient with that. There'll be times when we're going along here, I'll tell you, we don't really know what this means. My expectation is someday we will understand. And as we look at this, just like we didn't understand certain parts of the Bible 100 years ago, God, through Spirit and time, we're able to, in scholarship, we're able to see and understand things that we didn't before. I'm confident we'll make sense out of this as years go by, too. Now, the Song of Solomon, talking about more formally now, properly now, the Song of Solomon is associated often with Passover in the days of unleavened bread. That's when it's often read in the Jewish communities over the past centuries. They associate it with Passover in the days of unleavened bread. Of course, it is a poem that is primarily takes place in the springtime. It also is suggestive, of course, of marriage. We have this cliche still in our Western culture of people getting married in spring. Springtime is when all the birds start twittering, right? And the little furry animals come out, and people are ready for love. And this helps support some of that tradition. It also suggests, if we associate this with Passover and Days of Unleavened Bread, it suggests a relationship between God and His people, that God has special attention towards His chosen people. And of course, this poem is a love song about marital love, about two becoming one. And of course, that has some typological message, you know, yes to human beings, but of course, has significance with regards to God seeing Israel as His bride, His wife per se, and her being loyal to Him, and of course, ramifications of the church and marriage between the bride and Christ the groom and returns in the future. Verse 1, chapter 1, we have the title again, the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's Song. And then we have, you're going to have probably in your New King James Version, a number of subtitles. The subtitles are something editors have added. There are no subtitles in the original document. And so these are things editors have added to try to help us understand. Not all the subtitles are agreed upon. Some scholars would say, no, this is what the subtitle should be. It should be this or that. I find the subtitles helpful. But at the same time, I recognize they've been added. They're not necessarily inspired to be put in there, although they can be helpful. And when you look at the Song of Solomon, you can almost, and some people have argued, it's almost like a drama. You have parts, as it were. The Shulamite, the young woman, is speaking apparently just kind of to everybody, and then she's more focused speaking to her beloved, and then she's addressing the daughters of Jerusalem, which is like another audience of young women who are watching her, apparently. And so we get a lot of this, and it can almost be read as a play, and some people suggest that. And so that might help us understand the different parts and what's going on here. But the main conversation tends to be focused between the Shulamite, this young woman. The Shulamite, that's her name, that's how she's called at times. Apparently, this is a young woman from Shulam, S-H-U-L-E-M, or Shu, S-H-U-N-E-M, Shunem. It's an unidentified place. We don't really know where it's at. Here's an example of some things we don't know. It may be a little village near Mount Gilboa. We're not sure. I don't need to bring out a map. Some scholars think the title Shulamite, which means peaceful, is simply the woman's married name. Some scholars see it as a feminine form of Solomon, and it's only used after marriage. And so, again, here you're saying it could mean this, it could just mean she's from a village, it could mean the feminine form of Solomon, signifying that she has become Solomon's wife. All these possibilities are thrown out there because we're not quite sure what it means. Here we find then, let's just dive in. Verse 2 through 4, we have this young woman, and it begins very interestingly and provocatively. There's this woman expressing her desire for her beloved. And so what we see as we begin here, apparently a courtship has already begun. We're kind of jumping in the middle of the story. There's a love that's already blossomed and bloomed, and there's a courtship going on. The Shulamite says, "Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine." Some scholars say affections rather than love, saying difference in certain ways. "For your affections, your love is better than wine. Because of the fragrance of your good ointments, your name is ointment poured forth. Therefore, the virgins, the young women, the maidens love you." And then verse 4 says, "Draw me away." Another translation you could say here, "Draw me after you." And also can also mean, "Take me away." You know, take me away. Her desire is to be with her beloved. Now, this is rather interesting. It seems to be she's thinking about this courtship has already begun. She's already come to have strong affection and love for this young man as the poem opens. And what has troubled some scholars, biblical Bible readers in the past, is that this is rather, this woman is expressing a sensuous desire for her beloved. She's wanting to kiss him, and not just a peck on the cheek, it seems to be. And this is rather interesting because in other cultures, women were not able to express these sort of feelings. But here in this, in the Bible, and this is what upsets some people, well, this is rather provocative. This is not, I guess it is kind of rated G stuff, but, you know, it's a little provocative for people. This is a little surprising to find something in the Bible. And you can also imagine, centuries ago, sex was seen as a bad thing, as something dirty. Okay, that was what the Catholics said, that's the original sin. It wasn't disobedience, it was what Adam and Eve did after they ate the apple, the sex part. They knew each other, okay? They knew they were naked and all this. A lot of that's based on their Catholic traditions. And then we shift to this scene. The daughters of Jerusalem and suddenly have this group of young maidens or of women, and they seem to operate in the way the ancient Greek chorus would be. They kind of stand to the side and they offer questions or they make statements that kind of keep the narrative moving along. And then the daughters of Jerusalem, she says, "Draw me after you, draw me away." She's speaking, as it were, to her beloved. And the daughters of Jerusalem say, "We will run after you," or it could be, "We will run together." We get this idea that it's almost like they're there encouraging her. They're there supporting her, supporting them in their courtship. And then the Shulamite, the next line here, still in verse 4, then she says, "The king has brought me into his chambers." And again, that seems to be like we're jumping around. She's just speaking, and then suddenly she's saying that she is in his chambers already. Another translation, this is where it becomes a little obscure for us. Another translation can be, "Let the king bring me into his chambers." Now, so with this, some scholars think, well, here it is. This is a love song about King Solomon and the Shulamite, maybe his first wife, maybe one of his wives. On the other hand, scholars also recognize that historically it was customary for brides and grooms to refer to one another as king and queen. That makes sense. He is my king. He is the king of my heart. So it could be something a little more generic, meaning this young man, or it could be a specific reference to Solomon. Either way, we get this sense that whether it's past tense, present tense, it gets a little confused in the translation, but we get this sense that this courtship has begun. And they're just waiting in anticipation for the day of marriage. And the daughters of Jerusalem come in again. the second to last few lines there in verse 4. That says, "We will be glad and rejoice in you. We will remember your love more than wine." And so it could be these daughters of Jerusalem have been like best friends to this young lady. They've witnessed her blessing of what every young woman wants, to fall in love with a great guy. And so they've watched this love blossom and bloom, and they're standing there in encouragement and in happiness, seeing that this couple, these two people, are becoming a couple. And it brings them joy. And if you've ever watched a young man and young woman move from "I kind of like you" to "I like you" to "I really like you and I even want to marry you," it's kind of fun to see that happen. And there's a certain joy and pleasure in seeing two wonderful people come together and desire to be married. And then the Shulamite say, "Rightly do they love you," seems referring to the beloved. You get the sense that the beloved, this young man, is respected by a lot of people, and they approve of him. And they approve of him in such a way, I guess there might even be, I don't know if they'd be jealous, but, you know, sometimes we want good for other people, even though we may not have that same relationship yet in our own life. We are pleased to see it when it occurs in the lives of others. Then verse 5, we get this self-critique. The Shulamite says, "Rightly do they love you." The other young ladies, "They love you, my beloved." And then we get a sense that she feels a little less attractive, that maybe she feels a little inferior. She may have a sense of insecurity about her own appearance. When you love someone, when you dare to admit you love someone, it's a scary thing, isn't it? It could be a scary thing because when you dare to love someone, you're daring to open your heart, which is a very tender, ooey-gooey thing, and you don't want it poked and hurt. But when you open yourself to love someone, you get a lot of sense of insecurity and unsureness about yourself. Is this a mistake? Should I tell him? Should I express these emotions? Do I let somebody in, as it were? And that's the way it feels for both men and women. There's that great insecurity. Love can be very hurtful. Better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all, Tennyson wrote centuries ago. She continues, "I am dark but lovely, O daughters of Jerusalem, like the tents of Kedar, like the curtains of Solomon. Do not look upon me because I am dark, because the sun has tanned me. My mother's sons were angry with me. They made me the keeper of the vineyards, but my own vineyard I have not kept." Well, what we get described here is apparently the Shulamite, we get the sense in this description, she's almost like kind of like a country girl. She comes from a small village, it appears. And we get the sense that her family, especially her brothers, kept her working in the vineyard. They kept her close to home. They didn't let her go traveling around. They didn't let her go unescorted. They kept her safe and sound down on, well, I don't want to say the farm, but in the vineyard, working under their care. And so her skin is dark. She is tanned. It's not this beautiful complexion like city girls, I guess we might say, that come from a better, a higher level of society, perhaps. I don't know if that's necessarily better. It's not. She feels unattractive, is how we might interpret this. She feels unattractive compared to the city girls. She feels inferior. And so she says, "Don't look at me. I'm not the beauty I could be. And it's my brother's fault. My family kept me hemmed in on the farm, on the vineyards. They made me the keeper of the vineyards, but my own vineyard I have kept not." What does she mean, "my own vineyard I have not kept"? Of course, we're using figurative language. What would be the vineyard, she says? What do you think she's talking about? Her own beauty, her own vineyard, her own beautiful qualities, she has kind of let go. You know, she hasn't kept up her skin. She hasn't kept up her hair. You can go on and on into that. In other words, she feels very unattractive. She feels rather unattractive. And so we get the sense as the song begins that she feels unattractive, somewhat inferior to others, and she's kind of angry at her brothers for doing this to her. But what we're going to find by the song's end, she'll be grateful to her brothers. Because what her brothers are actually doing, I'll let you know, they've been protecting her. In essence, they have been protecting her reputation. they have been protecting her virginity. They have not let anyone come into her life that wasn't worthy, that was trying to do her harm. In other words, they were guarding her chastity. They were protecting her, helping her to stay pure. And so they did place restrictions upon her. And so it's actually a good thing they're doing, is, and she will see that, as we'll find by the end of the poem. Verse 7, now she addresses her beloved. And so we're not kind of shifting now. It seems like we're still in the country. Now she says, tell me to her beloved, tell me, O you whom I love, where you feed your flock, where you make it rest at noon. For why should I be as one who veils herself by the flocks of your companions? So now we get, it seems to be suggesting that she's addressing her beloved, wanting to know, where are you going to be? Where are you going to be today? Where can we be together? And so we get the sense that she has strong desires for him, and she wants to spend time with him. She wants to be with him. Now, we're not talking about she's wanting to have the secret rendezvous. It's not about sex, but it's more about, I want to be with you. I miss you. I want your companionship. It's a lovey-dovey stuff. It's what it seems to be talking about. She doesn't want to be wandering around like somebody lost among these other shepherds and their flocks trying to find him. That would be a little embarrassing, a little dangerous. She's wanting to know, where are you going to be? And the beloved responds, verse 8 through 10, if you do not know, O fairest among women, follow in the footsteps of the flock and feed your little goats beside the shepherd's tents. So it almost sounds a little bit teasing. Well, I'm not really going to answer you. If you want to know, you're just going to have to find my flock and just follow my sheep. Just as my sheep, my little goats follow me, you need to follow me too. Some scholars see this as maybe his answer is being a little playful. And then he continues on with this beautiful analogy. He tells her, I have compared you, my love, to my filly among Pharaoh's chariots. Your cheeks are lovely with ornaments, your neck with chains of gold. Well, what's a filly? It's a female horse. So he says, you're a horse. Do you think that's meant to be a put down? Now, to us, I don't think it'd be very, I wouldn't recommend you telling your beloved or your wife, you're like a horse to me, dear. I love you. You're as important to me as a beautiful horse. It wouldn't go well. Even if you said, my darling, I love you like a guy, any guy would love his Corvette. Okay, you don't do that. But this is not a put down. I'm trying to draw it out, show there. We could look at this. What you're going to see here when we read this poetry, we can have fun with the Song of Solomon, because if we look at the imagery as more literal, it seems like it's full of put downs and obvious absurd comparisons, and they're kind of funny. But if we try to take ourselves back 3,000 years, roughly speaking, understand the context of their history and time in what was esteemed in their society, we will find that these are not put-downs. These are actually very beautiful metaphors. Now later, had a little fun, and I'll share these with you later, but I went and found some of our love songs in our century, lyrics, and I'll show you that our metaphors can be just as silly and interesting as well, without the music, okay, just lyrics. This is not a put-down. You see, a horse was considered the finest of all animals. A horse was the most graceful, beautiful creatures God created, as far as their society saw it. Okay? And any of you love horses? Yeah, they are beautiful animals. Not only is their beauty, their strength, and there's power, and then there's something about, you look in the horse's eyes, and they're rather expressive, aren't they? And they're very companionable. They're very beautiful. The horse was the finest of animals. Now, here's something else to understand. I have compared you, my love, to my filly, to a beautiful female horse among Pharaoh's chariots. What kind of horses would have drawn Pharaoh's chariots? Well, they're the fastest, strongest of horses. They're always stallions. They were always stallions, at least two per chariot. And they are ornamented. They're heavily ornamented, both with armor and just with trappings that were very beautiful. So he's saying, you're like a filly among the stallions. And so he's letting it be known that other men value her too. He recognizes her, that she'd have attracted to all sorts of men out there. So he's trying to encourage her, you might say, that where she has been feeling inadequate, not very pretty, he's saying absolutely not. I guess today we might say something, you're drop dead gorgeous. Okay. And anybody, any man, young man would want you, but I'm not going to let them have you because you are mine. And so it's kind of setting up this idea of you belong to me. Also, when it says your cheeks are lovely with ornaments, your neck with chains of gold. Typical of that day, she would have had jewelry. Some scholars suggest that maybe even a veil of sorts with coins or something on it, something very pretty. And so she has her hair done up nice. She is very beautiful and she is adorned. And of course, if they're talking about a wedding day, he's even imagining how she's going to be decked out with all the most beautiful trappings on their wedding day. So this is not a put down. He appreciates her beauty and her jewelry against her face and neck. He's trying to say this is something highly valued. She is highly valued. And yes, the other men notice your beauty, but they're not going to have you. You are mine. In verse 11, the daughters of Jerusalem seem to agree with him. They say, we will make you ornaments of gold with studs of silver. Could be a suggestion. They're looking forward to the time when they will help her adorn herself for their wedding day with the beautiful gold and silver that she will wear one day at their wedding and make her even more beautiful. And then verse 12 through 14, we shift to another statement. This is a Shulamite now. And it seems to be a reference to what she does to help prepare herself. Her love for her beloved is such that she is taking care to make herself attractive to him in every way. And she says, while the king is at his table, and again, the king here, it could be a reference to her beloved. Every young woman's beau, husband-to-be, and husband is a king in their mind. While the king, the beloved, is at his table, my spikenard sends forth its fragrance. A bundle of myrrh is my beloved to me that lies all night between my breast. My beloved is to me a cluster of henna blooms in the vineyards of En-Gedi. Well, what are all these things? The king at his table, some scholars speculate, well, maybe this is just extravagant metaphor. Maybe they've met for like a picnic, possible setting outdoors, and yet the table is just maybe a simple cloth on the ground or something. This is what scholars try to do to understand the movement here. And what's this reference to spikenard, myrrh, henna blooms, things like this? A spikenard is a plant, and from it they make this expensive aromatic oil, and it's known for its seductive charms. It's a very pricey perfume. Of course, women wouldn't put on perfume today, right? To try to make themselves more alluring, more attractive to the one they love. Well, of course they do. Of course. It appeals to the senses. She is no different. And then it says, a bundle of myrrh is my beloved to me that lies all night between my breast. This is part of a beauty treatment, quite possibly. Myrrh is an aromatic gum. It's made of a resin, you might say, not chewing gum, but it's a resin. It's a soft substance, and it was used as a perfume. And it seems to be the idea that she puts it maybe in a pouch and has it on her chest all night long. And so that perfume, it kind of gets into her skin. It's with her all day long. And again, it's what she does to make herself more pleasing to her beloved. And my beloved to me is a cluster of henna blooms. What is he to her? Well, he is absolutely beautiful. He is a beautiful aroma to her as well. Henna blooms is a plant, blossoms from a plant that were used to make a sweet-smelling perfume. Well, it's kind of interesting. We don't, in our songs today, we don't usually refer to perfumes and aroma as part of the allure of love, but back then they did. They appeal to each other. It's using all the senses, you might say, not just the eyes, in the sounds of the words they speak, their voices, but even the smell. It's all this idea as a reminder of how much they love each other and how they're trying to make themselves attractive to each other. Then the beloved has compliments to her. Verse 15, he says, behold, you are fair, my love. Behold, you are fair, meaning very beautiful. You have dove's eyes. Okay, now, you know, literally, okay, that's kind of creepy. What he means by dove's eyes, what would you suspect does he mean? You have dove's eyes. What would be your guess at this? Morgan, what do you think? You sniggered and looked down. I got it. What do you think they mean? My love, you have dove's eyes. You're saying this to your beloved. What do you think he means?
Dove is like a sign of peace, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe like innocence too, kind of. Mm-hmm. That's what I would think, like purity or what.
Yeah, yeah, dove's eyes. Very good. You all agree with that? Sounds pretty good. It really does. Dove's eyes, the idea that she's beautiful, soft, gentle, peaceful, all of these things. I think we can get that would be a nice compliment. I don't know if you'd say it that way today, but it was meant as a beautiful compliment. And it's interesting that he's looking at her eyes. Maybe it's because everything else of her is all covered up. In that culture, you just didn't show apparently, skin when you were still just a virgin maiden, especially to a possible beau. You wanted to be protective, but the eyes are the windows to the soul. I think that's something else we see here. And she says back to him, verse 16 through 17, "Behold, you are handsome, my beloved." What guy doesn't want to be told he's handsome? Okay. "You are handsome, my beloved. Yes, pleasant." And so she's returning these sweet little nothings, you might say, these encouragements back to him. And then we make this, then she talks about, "Also, our bed is green. The beams of our houses are cedar and our rafters of fir." If we look at this a little more literally, it seems to, again, suggest where we started. This is somewhat of an outdoor setting. Remember, she is asking, "Where can I find you with your goats and among the shepherds and so on?" So sometimes scholars look at this as maybe this has been an outdoor scene. And then if that's the case, and if this is somewhat like a picnic scene or something like that, this little getting together here during the day, it can refer to the trees they're sunning under, the privacy of trees out in this kind of what we'd call like a romantic countryside, the privacy there. It's sort of a garden scene, even though it's not like the garden we're going to learn about later. It could mean the beams of our houses are cedar. They're sitting under the cedar trees, fir trees. Of course, we also know that later on, Solomon actually built houses with cedar and with fir, pine, aromatic trees. So scholars go back and forth again, the enigma here, what exactly going on. I tend to see this, I can see it either way, but I guess I kind of lean to seeing this as it's a romance of courtship, semi-privacy of nature, picnic under cedar trees. And of course, there's a suggestion, our bed is green, this parallel to the actual marriage bed that they know one day they will have. They're planning on getting married. Now, some scholars want to say, oh, look, this is obviously is premarital sex going here. They're talking about a bed. I don't see it. I disagree. There's no proof of premarital sex, as some would claim. Our bed is green. It could just be kind of a reference to this is our private chamber now. But we're waiting and looking for the real privacy of a real chamber after marriage. Any questions so far? That's the end of chapter one. Yeah, John?
So how do we know for sure that they're not married yet?
Like, it's because, I guess, in the sequence of things we find later on, which seems to be the wedding procession is what's going to happen here in a little bit, the next chapter. And so some scholars suggest maybe they are married. How do we know? In this poem, there are some things that are just hard to know 100%. I take this more as as you can see in the outline, I see this more as a movement from courtship in the beginning, as a procession, a progression from courtship to marriage, and then after marriage. And that's how a lot of the more conservative scholars look at this. That's maybe not be a real satisfying answer, but there's just a lot of unsurety about what's going on in certain parts of this poem. Yeah, Haley?
In verse 4, it says, like, the king has brought me into his chambers. I just, like,
yeah.
I don't know. Does that, like, imply something?
Where are you at? You're at
1, verse 4.
The king has brought me into his chambers. I guess because there is a possibility that one of the Hebrew words, it's either the king has brought me, or some translation says, let the king or allow the king to bring me into his chambers. So it's almost like it hasn't happened yet. So Some of the translations, some of these Hebrew words, the meaning is unclear. So is it actually speaking of a past tense? This has happened? Or is this more of command now? Or is this more hinting at a future possibility? And that's where some of the ambiguity is. Some of our translators, of course, they look at this and they have their ideas what it means, so then they interpret it according to their view. But when you go back and look at the Hebrew words, there's a lot more of ambiguity going on. And so I guess what it means to you ultimately is in the eyes of the translator and how you interpret it. Yeah, those are good questions. And it kind of points out what I'm saying. There's just, I'd like to be more definitive at times because I like clarity as well. But to be fair with what is going on here, there's times when it's not so clear. It's kind of like we're standing on jello in certain parts here. Let me read these next few verses, and I'll give you a taste of how it compares. Chapter 2, and again, let's see, what is the New King James Version here says? They make a clean break here from chapter 1 to chapter 2 in my King James Version here I'm looking at. That has a subtitle here. This is not scriptural. This is a subtitle the editors put in my version. Beginning verse 1 of chapter 2, it says, a country girl in a palace. And so it's going back to this idea that she feels like a rather insecure about her own looks. And in verse 1, it seems to be almost as if she's putting herself down, that she's just a simple flower, not at all very pretty compared to the luxurious lilies of the other girls, other young women that she sees. And that's how interpreters will look at this. She says, I am the rose of Sharon, and the lilies of the valleys. And these are wildflowers. These are, you know, they're beautiful in their own way, but they're not quite like the luxurious flowers you might see in a well-kept garden. They're just simple flowers. And in her mind, they're not very pretty. But the beloved says, you're like a lily among thorns. Like a lily among thorns, so is my love among the daughters, among the other daughters of Jerusalem, the other young women. And so we can read this. She seems insecure about her looks, but the beloved says something very encouraging. He's actually praising her for her beauty. She's superior in beauty. To beloved, the Shunammite is unique. She's like a beautiful lily among thorns compared to the other women. That's a huge compliment, isn't it? That's a huge compliment. And what does she say about him? Verse 3. Like an apple tree among the trees of the wood. See, she doesn't compare him to a flower. He's a man, and he's strong, and he's generous and kind. She says, he is like an apple tree among the trees of the woods, so is my beloved among the sons. So he has superior strength as well. I sat down in his shade with great delight, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. He's an apple tree. And what is his fruit? Most scholars equate, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. That's probably kisses. Probably some kisses of affection here. And so he praises her beauty, and she praises his qualities as well. He's strong, unique, a provider of things desirable and delightful. She likes to be in his presence. And this isn't something unusual. Young people courting one another like to be in each other's presence. Now, I just want to make a point out something here. You ready for something kind of fun in this regard? Here's a song back in the day. This is called Silly Love by 10cc's. Here's verse 3 of this song. It's a silly love song. Hey, Toots, you put the life into living. You brought a sigh into sight. Ah, hun, you make my legs turn to water. You bring the stars out at night, but they ain't half so bright as your eyes. This almost sounds like a Song of Solomon. No, not quite. And it says, ooh, Trej, like treasure. Oh, Trej, you got a smile like a Rembrandt. Aha, you got the style of a queen. Oh, dear, you are the petal of a rosebud. Next to you, all the others could be weeds. You are the only one my garden needs. Aww. But doesn't this sound a little bit like what struck me about it? I think the guy read the Song of Solomon. Because he says, you're like a lily among thorns. Like a lily among thorns, so is my love among daughters. This guy wrote, next to you, all the others would be weeds. You're the only one my garden needs. See? We're not so far away from Solomon. This is written, I think, probably back in the 70s or 80s. Don't worry, I got one written by One Direction we'll look at later on here. Because I know you know One Direction. Okay. All right. As we continue on in verse 4 of chapter 2, it seems to be a continuation of this idea. Scholars make a case that there's like a picnic in the woods here, part of the courtship. The two, the young man, young woman, spend a little time together. Here the Shulamite, the lady, the young lady is speaking to the other young ladies. Verse 4, she says, he brought me to the banqueting house. It seems to be figurative, possibly again reference to the same place they're meeting under the trees, this kind of picnic meal. So some scholars see this. And again, the ambiguity there, it makes it possible. And his banner over me was love. And so it's like they're in this beautiful canopy over them, and it's their whole time together, their whole relationship is over, it's covered over with this idea of love. Sustain me with cakes of raisins, refresh me with apples, for I am lovesick. Well, there's apples again. And of course, that takes us back to the idea we saw earlier about he is like an apple tree to her. And so it appears she may be talking about kisses, or maybe she wants his kisses. And notice she says, I am lovesick. I am lovesick. It's not unusual through much of literature and in the Bible too, falling in love, being in love. It can be like a sickness. It's often described as a sickness. You can't eat, you can't sleep, you're miserable. And she says she is lovesick. Perhaps this also refers, verse 4 through 5, there more of this desire to be married, this desire to make this more of a permanent thing. Verse 6 through 7, this may be either this is his affection towards her, or this is her longed for wish of intimacy. It would seem to be this is something that normally would not occur, but maybe this is her anticipation of their love as a married couple. His left hand is under my head, and his right hand embraces me. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or by the does of the field, do not stir up nor waken love until it pleases. And so right after we have this phrase, I am lovesick, and then we see verse 6, his left hand is under my head and his right hand embraces me. That's a very passionate position, embrace of love. Scholars suspect that might be her anticipation, because then it's followed, I charge you, daughters of Jerusalem, do not stir up or waken love until it pleases. Why by the gazelles or by the does of the field? These are very beautiful animals, and in their culture, they were also symbols of young maidens, virgins, and very beautiful, gentle. And so what is she saying? She is making this warning to other young ladies like herself to wait for the appropriate time to awaken love. Don't open yourselves to such feelings of desire and love until the time is right. Now, have you ever been warned that? Yeah. You know, you may be wise enough to recognize, and you're 14 years old, and you've been struck with puppy love, as we sometimes call it in our culture, you may not be ready to get married. And sometimes when you're 20, you may find, okay, I found the right guy, I found the right gal, let's get married. Well, be careful of awakening love, of opening up those feelings too much to love if your beau doesn't have a job. He's still living in his parents' basement. And sometimes you have to, don't get me wrong. But, you know, there's sort of a checklist we should have, you know, to help us evaluate, am I really ready for this? That's a huge step. And some have made that step, and it works out, and it can be hard. But if you're a little more prepared, we'd encourage young people, especially the young man, to make sure he's got a job, he's got a skill that he can practice. It doesn't mean you have to go to college, but necessarily you have to be able to provide for your wife. You have to be able to provide for her safety and security. And if children come along, you need to be prepared for that. Likewise, young women, they need to be totally aware of what they can offer, the stability they can offer to relationship. Marriage ultimately is two becoming one, and you know, oftentimes children are a part of that equation. It makes sense to wait till the time is right. Feelings are very powerful things, and God gave us these emotions and feelings. Yet at the same time, we need to rule over them. But sometimes they're very hard to do, especially when it comes to matters of love. It's a very powerful, powerful feeling, emotion, passion in it. And it all seems like it gets out of control sometimes. You get this idea of lovesick. Once you awaken it, it's hard to control. And so even here, the Shulamite is warning the other young girls, be careful of opening yourselves up to such feelings of desire until the time is right. When the time is right, things will likely go much more smoothly. When the time is wrong, it could be a long time of agony and almost like torture, frustration, and other things. Verse 8, the Shulamite says, here we seem to have a shift now. It's like we make this leap. There's a gap and we're someplace else now. And a shift of tone and scene. Verse 8, and it's sort of figurative. It seems to reflect the wait part of their relationship. They're wanting to become married as one, and yet we get a strong sense here, verse 8 through 14, that they both are recognizing the time is not quite right. The time is nearing, but it's not quite right. We're still in the courtship stage, is what most scholars see here. The Shulamite says, verse 8, the voice of my beloved, behold, he comes, leaping upon the mountains, skipping upon the hills. Ladies, would you like to see your future beau leaping upon the mountains and skipping upon the hills? It's kind of funny imagery, isn't it? My beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. Now, a masculine male gazelle, a male deer, stag, these are symbols of virility. These are symbols of masculinity. Everything attractive in a young man. He's strong, he's good looking, he's got a little swagger. These are attractive things in their culture, and it seems still be somewhat attractive thing in our culture. These are symbolic. He's leaping upon the mountains, skipping upon the hills. Remember, it's springtime. Winter's over. The world seems to be alive and new and fresh. And what was it? In the words of Chaucer, you know, this springtime was when the thoughts of young men turned to love. Okay, this is what's happening here. It's a very old tradition. My beloved is like a gazelle or young stag. Behold, he stands behind our wall. He is looking through the windows, gazing through the lattice. Now, that sounds kind of creepy. If you take it literally, it seems she's back within the vineyard, within her protective family setting. Her brothers, or we're going to see, are there guarding this idea that she is not his yet. And this is why we think, at least this scene, it doesn't quite seem to be the marriage. They're not married. We get the idea then that the man is desiring her to join him. The man wants her to join him in marriage. And she sees him waiting, looking through the wall, on the other side of the wall, apparently of her mother's and brother's home. In a sense, you might get a sense like she is being kept separate. It's as if her home, her family is treating her like she's kind of in a little domestic prison here. They must be separated. The idea here, the time is not right. They must wait. Verse 10, my beloved spoke and said to me, rise up, my love, my fair one, and come away. For lo, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone. The flowers appear on the earth, the time of singing has come. The voice of the turtle dove is heard in our land. The fig tree puts forth her green figs, and the vines, the tender grapes, give a good smell. Rise up, my love, my fair one, and come away. Doesn't that sound alluring? Just come away with me. It's his call. Come, be mine. We can make this kind of creepy, but I suspect it's more making sure she knows that he wants her to join him in marriage. He has chosen her. He wants her for him. Verse 14, O my dove, In the clefts of the rock, in the secret places of the cliff, let me see your face. Let me hear your voice. For your voice is sweet and your face is lovely. Now, this imagery is a little unusual. This is the second request, you might say. He's calling for her to join him. And the imagery seems to be she is like a dove that won't come out of its hiding place in the rocks. Wild doves have their nest in the rocks and the cliff. They're kind of hard to get to, and they're not easily drawn out. She is being very timid. She's waiting. She's waiting till the time is right. She is not coming out just because he's calling her. She is being rather protective and waiting till the time is right. It seems like she's trying to keep her own advice that she gave to the other virgins, waiting for the time is right. What we seem to see here is that both the young man and woman, each in their own way, are struggling with anticipation. They're both struggling with love to keep it under control till the time is right. They seem to understand that full intimacy is for marriage. Yeah, there's the looks, there's the sighs of, I love you, and all this. But you got to be very careful of that. The premarital things can be very dangerous. Once the passion hits and physical touching and kissing begin, that can be a really hard animal to hold back, if you catch my drift, right? There's a metaphor for you. So they seem to understand they had to be very careful. And their culture was one where you had to wait to the right time, and that right time was after you're married. Verse 15 is a very enigmatic verse. Let's just read it, and I'll try to help you understand what they think is going on. Catch us the foxes, the little foxes that spoil the vines, for our vines have tender grapes. Now, this seems to be the brothers, is what most scholars see. This seems to be the voice of her brothers. Remember, her brothers representing her family are very protective of her. She is very precious to them, and they must protect her from predators. You get my drift. Until the time is right. They're preserving her, keeping her safe and sound, especially her virginity, her reputation, until the time is right when she is given in marriage. The foxes could represent the destructive emotions. Back culturally speaking, historically speaking, wild animals are attracted to fruit. And they can get into the vineyard, and in their desire to eat the grapes, they can tear down some of the vines and do a lot of destruction. I grew up on the farm. My family plants a lot of watermelons and cantaloupe and things like that. That's our money crop. Coyotes get out there, and they'll tear open the melons. They'll ruin it. And so I can kind of relate here. I kind of see where some scholars might say that. The little foxes that spoil the vines. Our vines have tender grapes. Could it be that the Shulamite, again, this young lady is represented by the grapevines? She is the vineyard, and they're having to protect her from his advances, you might say, his premature advances. So they're being very protective. All people seem to recognize love as this powerful emotion. And it could be she's having to tell him, remind him, I know what you want, but you can't have it yet. I know what I want, but I can't have it yet. We have to wait till the time is right. Verse 16, the Shulamite says, my beloved is mine and I am his. And so they know they've made promises apparently. They know they belong for each other. My beloved is mine, I am his. He feeds his flock among the lilies until the day breaks and the shadows flee away. The day, some see the day may be a reference to the wedding day, and the wedding day and the wedding night in this poem, that perhaps anticipation of the glorious wedding day that they anticipate. The shadows that flee away, this dark time to them of having to wait and you know, not give in to their emotions and passions, they're waiting for that day until the day breaks, the day rises, the glory of that beautiful day, the sunlight and beauty of that day. Turn, my beloved, be like a gazelle or a young stag upon the mountains of Bather. Again, this is a little obscure. Turn, my love. In other words, she may be saying to her beloved, turn and go now and be like a gazelle or a young stag. Be the wonderful young guy you are, but upon the mountains of Bather. Bather, B-E-T-H-E-R here, some translations, it means separation. So it could possibly mean, go away, be your beautiful self, but we must remain separated. We must remain apart yet. Okay? So she is wanting intimacy with him, but they recognize they must postpone until the time is right. Some of this is starting to make sense as we read this song. And again, there are other ways of reading this, but this is a little more, this is typically a conservative, more conservative approach many scholars take. Chapter 3, Song of Songs, verses 1 through 5. Again, this is somewhat of an obscure thing. We're not sure what's going on. It's another shift of scene. And many scholars see this as maybe a dream sequence. Maybe this is describing the young woman's nightmare or restless dream she's having. If you ever fall in love, and I hope you do, and the time is right, and it's all of your choice, all those things, you will find you in courtship. Courtship is not a calm and peaceful thing. Courtship is a time of ups and downs, of a lot of fear, a lot of insecurity and worry. And that seems to be reflected in what she is experiencing here. Verse 1 through 5, let's just read through this. Or by night on my bed, or some translation say in the nights on my bed, I sought the one I love. And so we get this sense that in her dreams. I sought him, but I did not find him. And so now we maybe shift into what she saw in her restless dreams. Verse 2, I will rise now, I said, and go about the city, in the streets and in the squares, I will seek the one I love. I sought him, but I did not find him. Now, we say this must be a dream because she's a country girl. She's in the vineyard, so to speak. So now it's a city scene. That's why some scholars suggest this might be a dream, one of these restless, nightmarish type dreams. Verse 3, the watchmen who go about the city found me. I said, have you seen the one I love? Scarcely had I passed them by when I found the one I love. I held him and would not let him go until I had brought him to the house of my mother and the chamber of her who conceived me. And so it seems to be this kind of dream sequence. Of course, if you're into analyzing dreams, psychoanalysis and all this, it could be maybe a reflection of this woman's recurring dreams or nightmares, expressing desire, fear of losing love, finding love. And again, we get the sense that she has to make sure everything's appropriate, mother's approval, parents' approval, all that. She searches for him while on her bed. So that's why we think it may be a dream sequence. And then it's quickly followed, verse 5. Again, I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or by the does of the field, do not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. Following on this dream sequence, it seems to be, again, a warning. Being in love is not a restful thing. It does not give you necessary peace of mind. Don't awaken love until the time is right. When the time is right, then the intimacy is appropriate. All these fears and worries will be gone. Then verse 6 through 11, what we finally see here now, a shift of scene again. Some translations call this the coming of Solomon. It's more correctly, also can be seen the coming of the bride. What many scholars see here, it seems to be describing the wedding procession. Suddenly, it's the wedding day. Suddenly, the wedding has arrived. And this set of verses seems to most likely describes the arrival of the woman in Jerusalem on Solomon's couch. Typically, the bride was brought in on this very ornate couch carried by young men and guarded by young men. Young men that were friends, family of quite possibly the groom. In other words, Solomon could mean the literal Solomon, I guess we could say, or it could be figurative. It goes back to this ancient idea that after Solomon was king, it became a saying, apparently, scholars tell us, that every groom became a king, became referred to as Solomon in all his glory, decked out. He was like the king, and the bride was like his queen he was to marry. Who is coming out of the wilderness from the country? Like pillars of smoke, you know, it's obvious for everybody to see. Perfumed, she's perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all the merchant's fragrant powers. Behold, it is Solomon's couch. Again, this can be literal or figurative. Scholars go back and forth. With 60 valiant men around it, of the valiant of Israel. They all hold swords, being expert in war. Every man has his sword on his thigh because of fear in the night. Again, it's customary for a bride to have an entourage to protect her on her wedding day. Oftentimes, there's family and friends surrounding her. So it could be metaphorical to lift this up to, you know, this beautiful queen is being protected by all these warriors, and which are actually her friends and family. Of the wood of Lebanon, Solomon the king made himself a palanquin. A palanquin is a fixed or stationary chair, oftentimes carried on the shoulders of men. He made its pillars of silver, its support of gold, its seat of purple. It's very regal and ornate. Its interior paved with love by the daughters of Jerusalem. So here, you cannot, love is not a concrete thing. It's an abstraction. So here, it definitely shifts more into a figurative language, saying it represents all that's wonderful, glorious, one of the most important, most beautiful, happiest things ever to occur in the life of a human being, culturally speaking, then, was marriage, wedding day. It's the best day of your life. And so possibly this description here of how she's being brought in on this couch as palanquin is reflecting that. Verse 11, go forth, O daughters of Zion, and see King Solomon. Again, literal, maybe figurative, of the groom. Go forth, O daughters of Zion, and see King Solomon with the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, the day of gladness and heart. Again, it's obscure. Scholars go back and forth. Is this literal or is this just figurative? And I have a note here. Until Jerusalem's destruction in 70 AD, a bridegroom was compared to a king. And the bridegrooms often wore crowns or garlands of laurels and some other headdress. Whatever it is, whether it's actually Solomon's wedding or someone being married as if he were Solomon, we don't know. But what it does seem to describe quite clearly, scholars will agree, it's wedding pageantry in biblical times. This is a wedding procession. Weddings were not just a 15-minute ceremony and then 45 minutes of pressed mince, punch, and white cake. Weddings in those days lasted a whole week. They were 7 days long. And feasting forever, it seems. How'd you like to pay for that? Well, that's your parents, right? Okay. Now to chapter 4. So the wedding has occurred by now. And what we get here in chapter 4, verse 1 to chapter 5, verse 1, is in many ways what happens after the wedding. And here things get a little more private, a little more intimate. I'm going to warn you. Okay. What we find right away is a traditional poem, and it occurs several times. In this poetic form, it's called a wasq. It's apparently an ancient Arabic form of poetry, and it's a traditional poem, and it's very descriptive, and it's full of extravagant praise for a person's physical beauty, and it usually is given in an itemized fashion. So it's like a list. It's like a list listing all the person's attributes. And wasq, W-A-S-F is spelled, but it's pronounced wasq with a hard K sound on the end. It is an Arabic term, and it means literally description. And so that might help us understand. So this just isn't something silly. This is traditional form. They found this poetic form in other places. And so what we have here, verses 1 through 5, is an intimate description in praise by the beloved, by the new husband, the groom, of his beautiful wife. What we have here, and this is where the giggles often ensue among teenagers and so on, they think it's just funny, but actually what this is the groom praising his wife as she undresses on their wedding night. Shocking! I saw your eyes go, what? Yeah. And what's interesting is he starts at the top of her head, as it were, and the itemization goes from the top down. And it's very beautiful, and it's meant to be flattering. And so let's look at this, and I'll explain to you as we go along what these metaphors seem to suggest. And if they're taken literal, this is where it's funny. But if we try to understand the historical context of these metaphors, I think we recognize this is actually, he's given her really beautiful compliments. So he begins, "Behold, you are fair, my love. Behold, you are fair." Typically, when you find something repeated like this, he's emphasizing her beauty. When you repeat yourself, it's for emphasis. "You have dove's eyes behind your veil." She's taken off her wedding veil. So now he can see her eyes quite clearly. "You have dove's eyes behind your veil." As we said, dove's eyes are beautiful, peaceful, alluring. They're just, I can lose myself in the limpid pools of your eyes. Okay, here's the first chuckle. "Your hair is like a flock of goats going down from Mount Gilead." Goats are smelly creatures. They're kind of dirty and they're pesky. But you have to go back about 3,000 years in time. You're standing at a distance and you see the flocks of sheep or goats that shepherds are driving over the mountains. And as they come down the hill into the group, there's this undulating movement. Okay? And I didn't grow up around goats, but I did grow up in wheat country. And maybe some of you did. If you've ever seen, another comparison here might be, I've read poems where people compare a woman's hair to the undulating waves of a wheat field. How the wind will blow a wheat field and make the colors change. That's kind of what he's trying to say about these goats. It's not that she has smelly hair, but it's that her hair is beautiful. It shimmers in the light. And it's probably has a curl. It's not straight. You know, it's undulating. It's beautiful to him. Goats were something you wanted to have a lot of. They were, it was something precious. It was a kind of a treasure. And so this is not meant as something unflattering. I think we understood that, but maybe we didn't always understand it. Here's another funny one. "Your teeth are like a flock of shorn sheep, which have come up from the washing, and every one of which bears twins, and none is barren among them." What do you think he means here? Anybody want to take a guess what he's talking about, John? Yeah, she's not missing any teeth. Would that be an attractive thing for a young man? Of course, you could chuckle about that a little bit. Can you imagine your new bride shows all her teeth and she's missing one or two? That could be kind of scary. But you know, love is blind, so it wouldn't really matter if you really love that person. But he's suggesting, as John said, your teeth are like a flock of shorn sheep. Shorn sheep, they've been freshly sheared, and so their wool is especially white and shiny. Her teeth are smooth. None are missing. There's no gaps. There's no gaps. Okay, you're sniggering now, but how many of you had parents that spent $10,000 or more making sure you had straight, perfect teeth? Okay, there you go. So we do value a good smile. My parents said, "You get what you got." Okay, that's fine. Verse number 3. Now this sounds like something we've come across in our poetry. "Your lips are like a strand of scarlet. Your mouth is lovely." What is he saying about her lips? Tell me, just yell it out, you know. They're red, aren't they? They're red and beautiful. We have love songs talking about lips like cherry. Okay, bright red. They're alluring. "Your temples behind your veil are like pieces of a pomegranate." Where's the temple? On your face. See, he's still describing her face. Yeah, the temple's kind of up here, the sides of your forehead, maybe. What does it mean? It's like a pomegranate. Yeah, pomegranates, you got the little seed thing, but the whole fruit itself is much larger, and it's typically a nice reddish color. It's a nice, beautiful hue. And so it seems to be saying, other scholars think temples actually is talking about the side of the face, maybe more like her cheeks even, quite possibly, depending on the translation. He could be suggesting that she's got this beautiful color in her cheeks, in her face. She's probably blushing a little bit. You ever heard of a blushing bride? She's standing there for her husband, and she's happy, and it's a beautiful moment. Verse 4, "Your neck is like the Tower of David, built for an armory, on which hang 1,000 bucklers, all shields of mighty men." Okay. So here he's saying your neck is like the Tower of David, built for an armory. How is that attractive? Any ideas there? Kira? Yeah, so you're suggesting, as you're saying, her neck must be nicely formed. And of course, we don't know what the Tower of David looked like. It would seem to be, must have been something rather architecturally beautiful. The idea of a tower is that she holds her head up and chin up like a queen, regally. You know, she's not slouched over, perhaps. That's part of it. So she has this, she's standing up tall and erect. Micah?
I don't know if there's actually a connection, but when Solomon built the temple, he made two pillars with pomegranates on either side of the door. Mm-hmm. So it could be talking about like the frame of her face as well, just like the, because mm-hmm. like those pillars would have been the frame, not the framework, but how it was framed visually. Yeah.
So she has this regal bearing. She's beautiful. The idea of perfection, part of it. And as far as this idea, built for an army in which hang 1,000 bucklers, what that would suggest is that most brides back then had this, it's almost like a veil made of beautiful metal, gold, silver. I think even among the Bedouins to this day, the young brides will have a veil, and the veil is often composed maybe of coins or metal pieces, and it drapes down over their neck, possibly. Or maybe she has jewelry around her neck. And so we get this sense of maybe multiple layers of jewelry adorn her neck. She has regal bearing. She's strong and sure of herself. And so possibly getting this idea of her personality is coming through. Then verse 5, your two breasts are like fawns. And again, she's undressing. This is a wedding night. This is appropriate. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle, which feed among the lilies. She's beautiful. Her breasts are like a fawn, a baby deer, tender, soft, and precious, suggesting that she herself is to be treated very gently, very tenderly, with lots of love. And so this is this description we have. This is a wedding night. All this, they've waited and waited, and now the time is right. You don't see a reference here warning them to wait till the time is right, do you? The time is right now. The time is right. It's a wedding. Verse 6, until the day breaks and the shadows flee, he's talking to her. Until the day breaks and the shadows flee away, I will go away to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of frankincense. Well, if you remember, she has decked herself with all these beautiful perfumes and aromas. She's made sure her body is very alluring, appealing that way. And so what we suggest here, until the day breaks, if this undressing has already occurred, then what awaits now is a night of ecstasy, the consummation of the marriage. The time is right. The time is right. And he continues on, verse 7, you are all fair, my love. There is no spot in you. In his view, she is absolutely perfect, absolutely, entirely beautiful. In verse 8, come with me from Lebanon, my spouse, with me from Lebanon. Look from the top of Amana, from the top of Sinir and Hermon, from the lion's dens, from the mountains of the leopards. Now this verse suddenly sounds weird, doesn't it? Wait a minute, I thought this is a wedding night. Now he's talking about coming off the mountain, from the lion's dens. What is all this? Well, there's several interesting things that goes on here in verse 8. First of all, verse 8, line A, the verse line, this is the first time, the first use of the word spouse. She's his spouse now. They're married. That's why we say this must be the wedding night. She is now his spouse. And figuratively, it's not literally, we don't think he means it literally, but figuratively, he's telling her, now it's time to come away from those mountains. Kind of like he told her to go away to the mountain of Bether, of separation. He's telling her, now it's time for you to come down from your mountain of separation. Come away from the mountainous areas of, figuratively speaking, the Lebanon and Mount Hermon, north of Jerusalem. It seems to be a call by the husband for his wife to now trust him entirely, to put down, put away any barriers, any distance that separated them, and trust fully with him together as they consummate their marriage. And so it's his way of saying, here we are. Here we are, just you and I together. And what we have then from verses 9 through 15 is a rather figurative, it's definitely rated G, okay? But the language is all the language of love. And there's imagery here that does speak of the intimacy that would happen between, that would be shared only between, that is to only be shared between a husband and a wife. And it's all in praise of his wife. This is beloved still speaking to her. Verse 9, what we're going to find here, there's a phrase that keeps occurring too in these chapters. And the phrase is, my sister, my spouse. This is going to be used 5 different times. And some scholars see here that this seems to be a sequence of events that of deeper intimacy as they consummate their marriage that night. So we see this occurring first in verse 9. You have ravished my heart, my sister, my spouse. And I'm going to come back and let you know, what is he saying my sister for? To us, that sounds kind of creepy, right? My sister, my spouse? Who? Well, culturally speaking, there's a reason. You have ravished my heart, my sister. That is not his sister, okay? Let's make that quite clear as we begin. It's only figuratively speaking. You have ravished my heart, my sister, my spouse. You have ravished my heart with one look of your eyes, with one link of your necklace. Scholars suggest this is the first step of their consummation that night. This is the arousal. His heart is totally aroused. His passion is aroused. And he continues to let her know, my heart is full of desire for you. And of course, now they don't have to wait. Verse 10 through 11, second time this phrase appears. How fair is your love, my sister, my spouse? How much better than wine is your love and the scent of your perfumes than all your spices? This seems to be the next step of kissing. Your lips, O my spouse, drip as the honeycomb. Honey and milk are under your tongue, and the fragrance of your garments is like a fragrance of Lebanon. This is kissing. I think it's safe to say, because it's here, this is not a peck on the cheek. Okay? This is full-mouth, passionate kissing in love, which, I warn you, is appropriate in marriage. Okay? Don't go doing like they do in these movies, you know, and all that stuff. You know what I'm talking about. This is full open-mouth kissing, passionate. We don't get a sense they did anything like this in their courtship days. Okay, this is something reserved, it seems, for the wedding night in their culture. So that's the second step. Third step, 12 through 15, this seems to be the consummation. And it's referred to as a garden. She has been a garden. She has been a closed garden to him, off limits to him. Now the garden is open. Now the spring, the source of her garden's beauty and all that she is a woman, it's opened up. It is his garden. She is his spring. Kind of takes us back to Proverbs chapter 5. He goes, a garden enclosed is my sister, my spouse, a spring shut up, a fountain sealed. That would refer to her virginity. A spring shut up, a fountain sealed. It was enclosed, but we're going to see by the end of this night, the garden will be opened. Your plants are an orchard of pomegranates with pleasant fruits, fragrant henna and spikenard, spikenard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with all trees of frankincense, myrrhs and aloes, with all the chief spices. And now you see a fountain of gardens, a well of living waters and streams from Lebanon. And what we have here, this is descriptive of the consummation of marriage, sex and marriage, okay, their wedding night. The wife is described as a lush, exotic garden. And they use all these exotic spices and odors that overwhelm the senses. It's lush, it's exotic. We're going to get a sense later, it's a private garden. It was once closed to him, but now it's freely open. Here, they finally enjoy what they have both been waiting for. Their anticipation is now joyfully fulfilled. This is the courtship. This is the wedding night now. In the Shulamite, now the young woman speaks. Awake, O north wind, and come, O south wind. Blow upon my garden, that its spices may flow out. Let my beloved come to his garden and eat its pleasant fruits. Now that's significant. The woman's garden, in other words, verse 12, and through here as well, verse 16, I should say. The woman's garden is no longer closed off, but open to receive the stirring winds of love, the stirring passions of her husband. The time for love is now right. Let my beloved come to his garden, verse 16. She's inviting her beloved into his garden. He is not forcing himself on her. She's inviting her beloved into his garden. This is an invitation to sexual union. What was hers and what her brothers helped to protect for her beloved one day, whoever that might be, it's been protected, and her garden is now his garden by right of marriage. And what we lose a little bit, we lose the beauty. Because we get some of it because of the figurative language. It's of a different culture and time. So we lose a little bit. And sadly, in our culture, they would probably turn this scene into something rather sordid. And so it's kind of okay, I think, to leave it as it were and try to understand what these metaphors mean. Let's continue straight on to chapter 5 because this is still part of this night. It continues right on to chapter 5. And this is the beloved now speaking. This is the fourth use of the phrase, my sister, my spouse. The beloved says, I have come to my garden, my sister, my spouse. Notice all the times he says my. My is possessive pronoun. I have come to my garden, my sister, my spouse. I have gathered my myrrh with my spice. I have eaten my honeycomb with my honey. I have drunk my wine with my milk. What we find here is the delighted husband takes his fill of love, of sexual love, this night. Notice that these verbs are past tense verbs. It's happened. Her charms are now his to enjoy, his alone, and so is sex and marriage meant to be. It's meant to be intimate between just those two. And then these last three lines here, verse 1, it's interesting because suddenly we shift. It's between this intimate conversation between just two people, a man to his wife, husband to wife, beloved to her beloved. And suddenly we get the shift of scene, last three lines, verse 1. Somebody suddenly says, eat, O friends, drink, yes, drink deeply, O beloved ones. Now, this strikes a lot of scholars as another enigma. What is going on? Here it's got this intimate love scene. Now suddenly this other voice. Who's watching them? It's saying drink deeply. It's as if someone's watching them. Talk about kind of creepy, right? Who could be watching this husband and wife and telling them to enjoy, O beloved ones? Who could that person be? Any ideas? I think it's God. I think it's God. Who created marriage? God. Who created sex? God. And what does God want for human beings? He wants them to be married. He wants them to be fruitful, to multiply, to enjoy the blessings of oneness with another, and ultimately then a family. It makes sense to me that this is God. God created marriage, and he blesses it. And this is his blessing. You know, eat, O friends, drink deeply. Eat of this garden, each your own private garden. Eat, enjoy, partake. And so the idea that married lovers should take their fill of sexual love. This is beautiful. This is, the society we live in, even religion, so-called Christian religion of the past, they want to turn sex into something dirty and shameful. And that is not what we see in the Song of Solomon. It is not. It's not something to hold up for all the public to see. It's a private garden. It's something secretive for you and your spouse. But it is blessed by God. When you take your marriage vows, it's between you, your spouse, and God. And so this kind of fits in here.